Welcome to today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, read by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas. This production is also available at recordinglibrary.org and on the telephone reader by calling 432-617-5555.
Hi, this is Linda, and today I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Section 1. This is Wednesday, January 8th, 2020. MISD spent $122,000 on bond materials by Brandy Addison. Midland ISD spent more than $122,000 on materials related to the $569 million bond election. The advertisements did not violate the Texas Election Code because they were informational and did not persuade readers to vote one way or the other. The first invoice was sent from Baselice & Associates on May 6 for $34,597. The payment was for the MISD voter survey conducted from April 17 through 23rd, in which 403 residents and teachers were interviewed. The final invoice of $29,450 was sent from Davis Demographics on November 2nd, 3 days before the election. The payment was for demographic consulting services. From May 6th through November 2nd, MISD received 14 different invoices. The Reporter Telegram obtained the invoices from Walsh Gallegos, Trevino Russo, and Kyle PC after submitting a public information request through the district. Other invoices were $2.60 from the district's printing department on August 13th for printing 26 copies of paper with bond-related information, $25 from the district's printing department on September 12th for printing 2,000 copies of paper with bond-related information, $238.50 from the district's printing department on September 20th for printing 45 spiral-bound booklets of 20 pages with bond-related information, $53 from the district's printing department on October 6th for printing 10 booklets of 31 pages with bond-related information, $30 from the district's printing department on October 3rd for printing 1,000 copies of paper with bond-related information, $6,004 from A1 Sign Engravers on October 9th for stickers for bond work, $588.16 from Fast Signs on October 9th for signs for MISD bond work, $6,084 from the Reporter Telegram on October 16th for print advertisements, $3,974.99 from the district's printing department on October 16th for printing 31,108 copies of paper with bond-related information, $22,863.35 from Valentine Direct Marketing on October 31st for 16,932 Election Day mailers, $9,692.71 from Valentine Direct Marketing on October 31st for 19,606 early voting mailers. This money comes from the general fund budget, according to MISD Communications Office. Planning and zoning clears way for MCDC to build new townhomes by Mella McEwen. Midland County Development Corp. is getting the chance to move ahead with some new affordable housing projects. Planning and Zoning Commission on Monday unanimously approved the MCDC's request for a zone change from SF2 Single Family Dwelling District in part and SF3 Single Family Dwelling to TH Townhouse Dwelling on a 0.780-acre tract at the southwest corner of the intersection of West Estes Avenue and North Main Street. MCDC Executive Director David Diaz told commissioners plans are to build 7 3-bedroom, 2-bath townhomes on the tract. Construction is expected to begin in the spring, he said. Commissioners also unanimously approved a request by Mark for a zone change from SF1 to PD, Planned Development District, for an office center at the northwest corner of the intersection of North A Street and Ventura Drive. Mark plans to demolish 2 existing office structures at the site and build a 2,360-square-foot day-use building and an 8,200-square-foot 2-story office building. Residential centers at the site will be unchanged. Also Monday, commissioners approved a replat of the southern half of a block in the Garden Addition at Ward Street and West Ohio Avenue, a portion of one lot and all of a second lot in Warwick Addition on the southeast corner of Winfield Road and Humble Avenue to combine two lots into a single lot. Parts of two lots in Chesmire Acres on the northwest corner of Neely Avenue and Cessna Drive to divide one big lot into three lots. Two lots in the College Heights Addition at West Washington and Carlton Street, and a 7.432-acre tract of land previously vacated portions of two right-of-way at Quail Ridge Road and Chucker Lane. Commissioners also approved a request by Schumann Engineering for a zone change from SF1 to SF3 on two lots at the southwest corner of College Avenue and South L Street. Local taxing entities' debt tops $800 million by Stuart Doreen. City of Midland debt issued last year has put the total payments from Midland's five taxing entities higher than $800 million at the end of the fiscal year 2019. The Texas Bond Review Board reported on its website that the City of Midland's total debt payments as of August 31st went from $210.002 million in 2018 to $272.134 million in 2019. The increase in the city's total pushed the total debt payments of Midland's five taxing entities, city, county, school district, junior college, and hospital district, from $777.890 million in 2018 to $809.311 million in 2019. The total debt payments in 2019 were $534.555 million in principal and $274.755 million in interest. The city issued debt in 2019 related to the road bond that voters approved in 2017, water sewer improvements in Northeast Midland, and other infrastructure. Total debt payments for the road bond and infrastructure-related certificates of obligation topped $80 million. The Texas Bond Review Board reported total debt payments dropped with the other four taxing entities, including the school district, $315.038 million to $298.510 million, and the hospital district, $200.036 million to $190.594 million. Much of the taxing entity's debt is voter approved. In addition to the road bond, the voter-approved debt includes referendums passed, including multiple school district bonds, the hospital bond passed in 2009, the Midland College bond approved in 2005, and the county bond passed in 2008. City of Midland debt includes certificates of obligation that were approved by the Midland City Council and not the voters. The Texas Bond Review Board also shows Midland County Water District No. 1 with $444.649 million in total payments, including $218.066 million in principal. Last year, the district's total payments were $454.468 million. Administrator discusses changes ahead of special election by Caitlin Randall. The Midland County Elections Office has implemented changes ahead of the District 2 City Council election later this month, including new chain of custody logs and overflow ballot boxes, said Elections Administrator Deborah Land. The changes were introduced following multiple issues with the November Midland ISD $569 million bond election. A recount resulted in an 820 vote discrepancy that was later attributed to a misplaced ballot box. It was discovered an overflow ballot box used after a standard election box is full was not documented on a chain of custody sheet for the ballot boxes and election equipment. Land said it's an error they're taking steps to correct before the upcoming election. We have a new chain of custody sheets that will be going out with every piece of equipment, thumb drives, and seals. We're going to implement a new way of keeping track of those seals at the location, she said. We think that's going to help a lot. At the last election, the elections office listed each item from a polling location on one chain of custody paper, Land said. She said they will now use a chain of custody form for each box and piece of equipment to track every little movement. Additionally, they will no longer use metal tins for overflow boxes, she said. Land previously said the misplaced ballot box was believed to not be from the November election because it was a tin box. The other ballot boxes were blue. County Judge Terry Johnson has ordered 50 more blue ballot boxes to ensure there will be enough for future elections, Land said. There will also be a change to the way the election results are posted on the county's website, she said. In the last election, what was posted as cumulative result did not include mail-in ballots, leading to reports the MISD bond passed by 12 votes. When mail-in ballots were included, it failed by 25 votes. Going forward, the number posted as the cumulative result will include mail-in ballots, Land said. Land's comments came following a test of the county's electronic voting machines, which County Attorney Russell Malm said was routine before every election. Normally, we don't make a big push to get the media out here and get the public out here. But because of the events that have transpired over the last couple of months since the November election, we want to make sure people see what we do and see the machines working, he said. There were two machines used in the November election, the DS-200 and the DS-450. The elections office tested the DS-200 machines on Tuesday, but did not test the DS-450 machines because they will not be used in the January 28th special election. The Secretary of State's office has instructed the elections office not to clear the DS-450 machines as the November election is currently being contested by several parties, Land said. There were three types of ballots tested by the machines in three separate tests on Tuesday: mail-in ballots, early voting ballots, and Election Day ballots. 81 ballots were used in each test, and the results reported by the machines matched the ballots. In addition to the procedural changes, Land said the elections office and election judges will receive training from the Secretary of State's office. Land said she hopes the added training and changes will restore residents' faith in the elections office. You trusted us before, it's the same people still working here, she said. We do our best every day for not just us, but we take pride in what we do for Midland County voters. We're working very hard to regain that trust. Please come back out and make your voice heard because it's important, she said.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, January 5th, 2020. Section E, Culture. Art meets artificial intelligence. Austin artists explore new meaning in data, by Ho-Jun Choi of the Austin American Statesman. Walking into Julia Morton's art gallery in Austin is, in a word, trippy. The cozy space is full of otherworldly art filled with shapes, scratches, and swirls. Some of the works are still images, while others are videos. At first glance, none of it seems to make any kind of sense. People freeze. They're mesmerized. They literally won't move, Morton said. It's like they have to look, and from what I've been told, get their bearings. Morton's work is part of a budding art form, one that uses artificial intelligence, AI, to generate images and visuals. Dubbed generative art, the works are created through non-human systems, such as computers. Artists have used algorithms and computers to generate art as early as the 1950s. University of Texas art history professor Taylor Bradley said the infusion of AI into the generative art genre is a relatively new development. Across the country, there are shows going up all the time about digital art, AI-generated art, smart technologies, and what have you, she said. I think there is plenty of acceptance and excitement over this new medium. Despite its recent arrival on the scene, Bradley said the practice of using AI to create art reminds her of a period in art history when artisans and craftsmen used to hone their various skills to create beautiful vases and furniture. I think artists have always been engineers who are inventing, innovating, and pushing the limits of technology, she said. Before Morton opened her East 6th Street gallery, named the Generative Art Project, she was entrenched in the world of fashion. She has also worked as an art columnist in New York. Morton said the new brand of AI-powered generative art forces people to look inward for meaning rather than using external context. For the first time in my life, in a very overarching way, this work is arousing our self-awareness of our animalistic nature, Morton said. Many of the artists whose works are featured in the gallery will first collect data sets found in the real world. Then, through the use of artificial intelligence, AI, artists find patterns in data sets that can be incorporated into their work through visualization tools. Because the data is grounded in reality, Morton said, people gain a sense of familiarity even in generative art that looks completely abstract. You get a feeling that you're in the presence of a living, real thing, Morton said, and that changes both how you experience the work as well as how you try to understand it. Morton's husband, James Pricer, is a local artist who creates art with the help of artificial intelligence. For one of his works, Pricer used data that he collected from a person's life, including their blood pressure, heart rate, and information. Though his art is largely enabled by the analysis powered by artificial intelligence, Pricer says the final part of his process depends on something much more human. What tells me that I'm finished is when I have a very strong emotional reaction, he said. Pricer, who has a background in data science, says he had long wanted to find a way to communicate to others the meaning he found in numbers. Traditionally, in the art world, you either had representational art or abstract art. Just like bridging tech and art, I thought if I could bridge representation and abstraction, that would make it possible for me to communicate what I see and feel in the data. And it's turning out to be true, Pricer said. Joao Beira is the founder of Datagrama Visuals, a company based in Austin that organizes performances and exhibitions using AI-generated art. Beira came to the United States from his native Portugal about 10 years ago to pursue a doctoral degree in digital media at the University of Texas at Austin. I realized that even though Austin is in touch with the musical experience, visually there was not really much going on in terms of bringing new ideas and doing things outside the norm, he said. Beira said the lack of an existing community is not necessarily a hindrance. Rather, he said it presents more of a blank canvas that he and other generative artists can fill. Austin might not be the first city you think about when you think about this technology, but the fact that the scene does not yet exist helps us build a foundation to build something here, Beira said. He said he finds meaning in generative art that is inspired by nature. You can find, for example, how trees grow and how they generate branches, or how the scales of a fish are organized, he said. You can actually replicate these different patterns and algorithms, and you can generate them in real time. Beira uses different programs to create his works, such as Deep Dream, an artificial intelligence-enabled software created by Google engineer Alexander Mordvintsev that studies patterns in images and generates its own shapes and colors based on the patterns that it has identified. Beira's company also uses software created by an Austin-based company called Synesthesia Live to create visualizations at live music performances. None of the visuals are pre-programmed by Beira to look a specific way. The added element of unpredictability, he said, is what makes AI-generated art exciting for him. Beira said he hopes his art can help people gain a better understanding of human consciousness and, in the process, themselves. It's not so much me being the creator and the ideas I have in my head, Bayera said. It's more about me being an architect, pulling all these things together and seeing where it takes me, because it's completely unpredictable how the machine learns to see the world, just like a child when it first starts to look around the world and begins making the notion of their own world. Hints from Heloise. Use grapefruit spoon to scoop out pepper seeds. Dear Heloise, I always had a problem when I cleaned peppers. I never could get all the seeds out. I seemed to work forever to get them all out, but always had a lot left. I don't know how I found this out, but now I use a grapefruit spoon, and it works like a charm. Just scrape the inside of the pepper, and out they come. Big D in Ohio. A New Year's Cleaning. Dear Heloise, with a new year comes the desire to clean out my pantry in the kitchen. It's a great time to get rid of those foods that are out of date or those that have been invaded by insects, usually weevils. I use a cup of bleach to a gallon of water to wash down the shelves. Then I dry them and return the food to the pantry. Everything is organized and clean for the new year. Maisie J., Klamath Falls, Oregon. Maisie, that's a great idea. To all my readers, I wish for you a happy and healthy 2020. Heloise. Sweet Cement. Dear Heloise, after years of having my brown sugar turn into cement once it was opened, I found a solution. I sealed it in a vacuum sealer, and voila, even after a month or two, it is still soft. I thought others might find this helpful. Pat C., Bessemer, Alabama. Cherry Surprise. Dear Heloise, please reprint your Cherry Surprise recipe. I haven't made it in a long time and have forgotten how, but it was the special request of my son who is coming home on leave from the military. Carrie in Mississippi. Carrie, anything for our men and women in uniform. You'll need to cream together 2 sticks of butter or margarine and 2 cups sugar. Beat 3 eggs and add into the butter-sugar mixture. Mix in 1 teaspoon vanilla extract, 2 teaspoons almond extract, and 1 pint sour cream. Then add 3 cups flour, 1 teaspoon baking soda, and 1/2 teaspoon salt. Mix to blend. Last, stir in 1 cup chopped maraschino cherries and 1 1/2 cups chopped nuts. Bake in a greased and floured tube pan at 325 degrees Fahrenheit for about 1 to 1.5 hours. When the cake has cooled, sprinkle with powdered sugar. FYI, when using powdered cake mix, put the water in the bowl first, then the dry mix. This helps prevent powder pockets at the bottom of the bowl. Heloise. Handy Hints. Dear readers, here are a few handy hints. Microwave a lemon for 12 to 14 seconds and you'll increase the juice it produces. Use latex gloves to open stubborn jar lids. Instead of using toothpicks for closing stuffed pork chops or chicken breasts, try raw spaghetti. It's edible. Heloise. Dear Abby, family pariah finds safety, but not security. Dear Abby, I have dysfunctional parents. For the sake of my sanity, I made the decision to remove them from my life. They have retaliated by spreading lies to immediate and extended family. I was supposed to get an apartment with my father to help him now that he is aging. However, he became violent and threatened to kill me. I moved away and am physically safe now. My problem is I'm now completely alone and a pariah on both sides of my family. These lodgings are temporary. I'm afraid they will fall through once family finds out where I am and poisons this very distant relative against me. How am I supposed to survive this? I have a job, but big deal if I have nothing to live for and no purpose. Anonymous Escapee. Dear Escapee, Your chances of having a more permanent roof over your head will be better if you tell this relative everything you have told me before someone else gets to him or her. Your father appears to have serious mental problems you are not equipped to deal with, which may become apparent in the near future when he acts out against someone else. You made the right choice. Your family members may be angry because they are now the ones who have to take care of him, which is why they have started the smear campaign. People survive situations like yours by performing their jobs well enough to excel and making new friends along the way. It's called creating a family of choice. Most of the individuals who do it thrive because the relationships are healthy ones. You have much to live for and many happy times ahead, so please remember that and concentrate on a future filled with possibilities. If you do, it is what you will achieve. Dear Abby, my husband and I have been together for 15 years, married for 6. We have the best relationship. Everybody tells us how great we are together. We don't fight, and we support each other 100% with everything. While my husband isn't overweight, he does go back and forth from going to the gym to work out and eating healthy to stopping and putting the weight right back on. I honestly couldn't care less about the number on his scale. The problem is, he's a horrible snorer. It's awful. I usually end up moving to the couch in the middle of the night to get some sleep. I have tried earplugs, headphones, you name it. He has tried the strips, the sprays, mouth guards, been to the doctor, everything. He always feels bad when he wakes up and finds me out of the bed. I've told him that it doesn't make me mad. I just get annoyed when I have to get up and go. The only thing that seems to make a difference is when he loses weight. How do I tell him that if he lost some weight, he would snore less? I don't want to hurt his feelings. Sleeping badly in Ohio. Dear Sleeping Badly, if you have observed that your husband snores less when his weight is down, tell him. It isn't hurtful. It would be helpful. You say he's been to see his doctor. Ask if he's been checked for sleep apnea. If there are long pauses between a sleeping person's breaths or gasping, it could be a symptom of sleep apnea, a condition that can be life-threatening. A diagnosis could be a lifesaver. Wild about Texas. Sandhill cranes usually are heard before they are seen. By Michael Price. To the budding Texas naturalist, it would seem as though the winter months do not afford ample opportunities to view wildlife because of seasonal inactivity. However, this is not the case, especially when the goal is to view wildlife that occupies this area for the few brief weeks of what we call winter. One of these wildlife viewings is the spectacular sandhill crane. Although the primary range of the sandhill crane is in the northern portions of this continent during the summer months, where the species comes from, when the seasons there begin to change to the brutally cold winter, it makes its home in the temperate climates of the southern continental United States, including the western two-thirds of Texas. As the crane makes its migratory journey to and from its winter home, it flies communally, rarely, if ever, venturing far on its own. Often they will fly in a V formation, although occasionally they will fly in a straight line. Regardless of the formation they fly in, they will often be heard before they are seen, as they have a tendency to sound off in a nasally trumpet-like song that can be heard from as far off as a mile away. This species of crane is large and can achieve body lengths of up to 4 feet and wingspans that can approach a whopping 6 feet. At first sight, it seems to have an almost gangly appearance. This stately look is due to the long legs and neck, as well as the large, straight bill. This almost comical look is exaggerated when this animal takes flight, as it takes several steps with its long legs as it gains enough momentum to take to the air. In flight, the downstroke of the wings is very slow and methodical, while the upstroke is rapid and jerky. Distinguishing characteristics of this bird as an adult include the bright red crown of the head, white chin and cheeks, light gray body and wings, and the aforementioned long neck and legs. Sandhill cranes are omnivorous, meaning that its diet consists of plants as well as animals, such as fish, frogs, crustaceans, and insects. It utilizes its long legs to walk great distances through the shallow water of marshes and playas to search for food. It also roosts communally in these areas, typically standing upright through the night. While on its winter retreat, the males, which are larger than the females, will attempt to court its prospective mate by a noisy and conspicuous dance that consists of leaping up to 8 feet into the air while calling loudly and beating its wings. If the female is interested in mating, then she will join in with the male in this dancing display. After such breeding, the pair remains monogamous and mates for life, and then both return to their summer homes. Upon arrival, both sexes will prepare the nest for the two eggs, which are incubated by both parents for approximately 30 days. The young will take their first flight at about 2 months of age. As with many large birds, it was wantonly killed during the earlier parts of the last century. However, habitat loss from agricultural use has been the largest conservational concern to scientists, but its numbers seem to be stable and even increasing. The sandhill crane can be quite common in areas of the panhandle, with large groups congregating in playas south of Lubbock, as well as in portions of the northern Edwards Plateau, with other communal sites occurring near the town of Robert Lee. Parsley is more than a garnish, by Barbara Porsche of Permian Basin Master Gardeners. Now is a good time to get a head start on an herb garden at your house. You should be able to find parsley seeds or maybe transplants at the nurseries or box stores. Parsley is like a vitamin pill. It is rich in vitamins A, B, C, and is a good source of calcium, niacin, potassium, and magnesium. An added bonus is that it deodorizes your breath, especially after eating garlic or onions. If you get some seeds, now is an excellent time to sprinkle them in your garden or any sunny spot in a flower bed. With the recent rain and hopefully some more soon, all the seeds that fell in my garden have suddenly sprouted. That is an added benefit. Parsley reseeds easily. At least the flat leaf variety does. The curly leaf variety is not so prolific, but be sure to plant enough for the caterpillars and butterflies. They love it. Parsley is a true biennial. It grows leaves the first year, then blooms and reseeds the second year, so you can see that I hardly ever have a time when I cannot go out and pick some for cooking. If you have a lot or purchase some at a store, you can put it in a glass of water like a bouquet of flowers, and it will last several days there or in the fridge. There are many uses for parsley besides decorating a plate. It can be used in almost any type of vegetable dish. New potatoes tossed with chopped parsley is a traditional Easter dish at my house. It can be chopped and tossed with cooked rice. Almost any pesto recipe has parsley in the list of ingredients. A big handful of fresh leaves adds a crisp flavor to a regular green salad. The stems are more flavorful and can be added to soups, stews, and stuffings. When you get a parsley decoration on your dinner plate at a fancy restaurant, don't leave it there. Eat it. If you have questions about growing parsley, call the AgriLife office in Midland at 686-4700 for more information. Mason has a population of characters, by Tumbleweed Smith. Mason is a hill country town of 2,500 residents with a courthouse square that's hard to maneuver. It has an extremely dense population of characters. Perhaps that's what makes the town so interesting. You can hardly go there without having some type of unique experience. One of my favorite eating places is Crockett Keller's Guns and Grub restaurant on the square near the Odeon Theater. One side of his building is the restaurant. The other half is his gun store. Crockett has some of the best seafood I've ever eaten. That's right, seafood in Mason. Crockett spends 3 days getting his oysters ready. I spoke at the library in Mason recently and did a couple of interviews while I was in town. One was with Ethan West, a barber who walked the 2,200-mile Appalachian Trail. Another was with Tony Plutino, a river guide who knows about the best places in Texas to go canoeing. I also interviewed Jan Appleby, who heads up the group restoring the elegant Sequist House, one of the first mansions in the Hill Country. It was built in the 1880s and has 22 rooms and 15 fireplaces. One of my early radio programs featured Mason County resident Fred Gibson, the author of Old Yeller. That set a high standard for future interviews in Mason. Mason is known as the gem of the Hill Country, maybe because topaz is found in the area. It also has an interesting number of people interested in making wine. The Bat Cave, just out of town, attracts visitors and scientists who study the nighttime scavengers. Fort Mason has created interest among people who research pioneer days. The city is a welcoming community and has many transplants from Austin and other places. They quickly assimilate and find things to do, working with the library, museum, chamber, or other organizations. The list of characters I've interviewed in or near Mason includes Bill O'Banion, who hit a golf ball 30 miles from Mason to another nearby town. Took him several strokes. Sculptor Bill Worrell lives on the Llano River, south of Mason, as does Laura Lewis, an artist who does murals in office buildings for Fortune 500 companies. Spider Johnson is an accomplished saw player. Gene Zetsch is well known for his wood carvings. Tom Hadley set high standards as a professional rodeo announcer. Tommy Splitgarber acted in some Hollywood movies. Ray Carrington taught fly fishing. I've done reports on Mason's courthouse clock, the Odeon Theater, where the world premiere of Old Yeller took place, the city's high number of tennis players, its historic homes, knife makers, store owners, photographers, entertainers, historians, storytellers, cowboys, and hunters. I interviewed one man long ago who took his pet llama for a walk around the courthouse square every evening. It just seemed like the normal thing to do. One man had a pet crow. Hector County Sheriff's Office receives cards from Cards for Kids. The Hector County Sheriff's Office received a box of holiday cards from Cards for Kids, a group that sends cards during the holiday season to children and communities affected by mass shootings. The group began sending cards after 58 people were killed in a shooting in Las Vegas, according to a letter shared by ECSO. This year, residents from 26 states and Canada sent in cards to be shared with affected communities, the letter states. "We hope that this brings a smile to your face and to your heart," wrote Jackie Schildkraut of Cards for Kids, "wishing you nothing but happiness, love, and laughter this holiday season." ECSO posted a video to their Facebook page of them opening the box of cards. Sheriff Mike Griffiths said in the video it was the most cards he'd seen in his life. "We've had kind of a rough year this year," Griffiths said in the video. "We're going to make 2020 a better year." Commentary. America's national debt deserves immediate congressional action, by J.D. Faircloth, District 11 congressional candidate. I believe the greatest threat to our great country is not from a potential military invasion by a foreign power, but literally from a self-imposed economic threat caused by our skyrocketing national debt fueled by Congress out-of-control deficit spending addiction. Today, America's national debt is more than $23 trillion, which is about $70,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. Our national debt now exceeds our entire annual gross domestic product and is more than 6 times our current annual federal revenue. Over the past 12 years, Congress has doubled the national debt by spending on average more than $1 trillion each year in excess of our annual federal revenues. Unlimited spending power has allowed government to not perform its key duties adequately without recourse, as well as gradually expanding its overreach further and further into the lives of Americans. America is rapidly drowning in its national debt, and many of our elected officials in Washington refuse to take the bold, unpleasant legislative steps to correct this significant problem to our nation's economy. Congress just keeps kicking the can down the road for future generations to solve. That's not right. It is our obligation to solve this problem and not penalize our children and grandchildren. So, what is the solution to our staggering national debt problem? The solution was stated almost 100 years ago by the great common sense humorist Will Rogers when he said, "When you find yourself in a hole, quit digging." That's what Congress needs to do. Quit digging. America is in a deep $23 trillion economic hole, and Congress just keeps digging deeper and deeper. That has to stop. If we don't stop increasing our national debt, I fear America could someday default on its national debt, triggering a massive worldwide economic catastrophe. In my opinion, Congress must take immediate steps to prevent that from happening. Financial experts agree that Congress must first reduce and then eliminate our budget deficits and then generate budget surpluses to reduce our national debt. This will not be easy, as Washington politicians don't get reelected by cutting spending. They get reelected by pork barrel spending. I believe we need to elect those who are dedicated and focused on reducing our budget deficits and our national debt as soon as possible. I am certainly not a federal budget expert, but in my opinion, Congress should consider passing legislation that acknowledges that our national debt is approaching a national emergency deserving of the highest governmental priority, begin implementing key provisions of the 2010 Simpson-Bowles Deficit Reduction Plan to formulate achievable goals of balancing our federal budget, implement the November 2014 Congressional Budget Office report that offered 79 options that Congress could take to reduce the annual deficit and national debt, prohibit future tax cuts without corresponding spending cuts, prohibits funding of new programs without corresponding reductions in existing programs, and establishes goals of reducing our national debt by $10 to $15 trillion over a 10-year period after the balanced budget is achieved. Balancing the federal budget and reducing our national debt will not be easy and will require significant bipartisan compromises on agreed-upon spending cuts, which, based on the current partisan hostility in Washington, doesn't seem very likely. But in my opinion, that must happen, as America really has no choice considering the worldwide catastrophic results that will occur if we don't. Oilfield Labs debuts expansion that doubles Midland footprint, by Mella McEwen. Oilfield Labs of America is preparing to debut its expanded Midland operations that will double the company's local footprint. Our company opened its doors 4.5 years ago, and we never anticipated the opportunities available to us, not just in the Permian Basin, but in several regions. Amanda North, the Houston-based firm's director of lab operations, said in a phone interview. We're excited about the chance to expand our Midland facility, double its capacity, and make a little more of a mark in the Permian Basin with our customers, she added, saying the expansion is expected to open Wednesday. The expansion involves not only expanding its existing building, but adding a second building, giving Oilfield Labs an additional 4,000 square feet of lab space, bringing the company's lab space in Midland to more than 9,000 square feet, and 800 square feet of office and administrative space, including a break room. We are a commercial laboratory, a third-party, unbiased lab, said North. Our goal is to deliver high-quality data at a reasonable price. We serve the oil and gas industry, analyzing water, oil, anything that comes from the ground. The biggest demand the company is seeing is from operators who want to do more testing and analytics at their well sites, she said. The company has field teams that go out to the sites to conduct on-site testing, and the lab at 3302 Pilot Avenue is equipped to conduct high-end, very sensitive analytics, she said. Everything goes back to the data, and with the demand for evidence behind every reason why action is taken, it's more important than it has been. There's still a lot to learn, but I believe the industry is learning and growing, North said. We're fortunate to be at the forefront of the industry. The projects we're involved in require deeper dives into the data and the testing methods used. With the state-of-the-art equipment in our labs, we're at more of an advantage. There's always something to be learned, and we're happy to learn. Not only will the expansion provide more space for current testing and operations, but it will allow the company to integrate more services into its program this year, she said. Space is always a big factor when you're working in close quarters. With the demand for more of what we currently offer, plus bringing in new methods and testing equipment, expansion was necessary. That expansion includes the company's workforce, which Oilfield Labs expects to increase this year. We will be looking for driven professionals looking for a career outside the traditional oil field, North said. We value integrity above all else, and there are some amazing people in the Permian Basin we've been fortunate to scoop up. We're also looking for technical expertise. In addition to the Midland location, the company has full-service labs in Oklahoma City and Cheyenne, Wyoming. Oil Report. Path to Profits. New study offers 5 levers to improve service company profits, by Mella McEwen. Oilfield service firms were hard hit when oil prices cratered in late 2014, and many continue to struggle as oil prices range between $50 and $60 a barrel and operators reduce activity levels. One issue is that those companies continue to rely on a business model built on $100 oil prices, according to a study issued by Deloitte. In Down But Not Out, Transforming Oil Field Services, the consulting and advisory firm offered what it called 5 levers to improve performance. Doing so could mean an additional $20 billion in earnings for the 70 service companies Deloitte analyzed for the study, and potentially in excess of $30 billion more in earnings across the entire sector. First, Deloitte said service companies should realistically assess whether it still makes sense to service their markets in the same capacity as when oil was $100 a barrel, or whether to consolidate operations, divest assets, or exit service lines altogether. Secondly, service companies should base their services on customer behavior, creating a bundle of services with a pricing structure that is flexible enough to offer a sustainable margin, and leading service providers should go to a more structured and sophisticated approach to pricing. Service companies can raise revenue and cut costs by reviewing their operating models and redeploying assets more effectively, the firm said. The fundamental ability to conduct business planning should be improved, allowing each part of the company to adjust their capabilities to meet demand according to that plan, even if it often changes. The fifth lever service companies can use is to rethink how they deliver services and equipment with technology, not offering data just as a service solution, but using data to enhance existing capabilities, Deloitte said. Digitalization can let service companies not only move faster, but connect equipment technologies together to improve delivery at lower costs. Sean Maxson, Principal and Oil Field Services Practice Lead at Deloitte, discussed in an email the study and how service companies are reacting to its recommendations. Question: how receptive do you think service firms would be to these strategies? Answer: we are already seeing service firms announce more aggressive actions to optimize their portfolios and align their operating models with the new market normal. For example, shifting to more basin-specific offerings and operating models to optimize returns on capital. The next step is to invest in new technologies, capabilities, and business models that will help operators enhance recovery, boost productivity, and reduce carbon emissions. For example, we are seeing oil field service companies invest in next-generation sensor and digital technologies to enable operators to optimize production and more efficiently respond to pump failures by leveraging advanced supply chain solutions. Question: what services do you see E&P companies demanding that service companies should focus on? Answer: E&P companies are clearly demanding that service companies provide cost-effective solutions that enable them to improve returns on capital. They are also looking for the service companies to invest in differentiated technology solutions and capabilities that will enable the next level of productivity and reduce carbon emissions. Question: we see the E&P sector working to implement cash discipline, generate cash flow, and return excess cash flow to shareholders. Do you see service companies experiencing similar restraints? Answer: the services sector is experiencing the same restraints and challenges as the broader E&P sector. Investors are focused on margins, capital returns, and free cash flow. Question: how long do you think it would take for these recommended strategies to take effect, and how would they affect both the service and E&P sectors? Answer: we are already seeing oil field service companies take much more aggressive actions to optimize their portfolios and streamline their operations to improve service delivery efficiency and returns. This will benefit both the service and E&P companies by creating increased service efficiency and a more sustainable industry structure. It will also benefit both the service and E&P companies by providing the industry with more capital to invest in the technologies and capabilities needed to drive the next level of productivity. The challenge for the industry is going to be finding a new equilibrium that provides sustainable financial returns across the value chain. County is taking care of its own with donation to animal shelter, by Tracy Gerhart, president of the Midland Animal Shelter Adoptables. The Midland County Commissioner's Court will consider Monday the allocation of funds to help sponsor the building of the new Midland City Animal Shelter. I appreciate the commissioners for acknowledging the shelter does accommodate the county animals. The shelter not only accepts all county stray animals brought to them, but it also accepts many owner-surrendered animals, along with multitudes of litters. They also take in and quarantine, a minimum of 10 days, the bite cases from the county. Shelter staff assists all animal-related arrest cases that occur in the county, assists on aggressive and injured animals, processes rabies specimens for testing, as well as deceased animal disposal. And of course, the shelter takes care of all the vaccinations administered to the animal at the time of intake, as well as spay or neuter at the time of adoption. The city does all this as a courtesy for the county animals and at no cost to the county. It is wonderful to see the community come together and want to provide the animals a shelter which will provide a safe and healthy environment. The new shelter will provide for the current needs of all the animals and continue to serve in the best interest of all the animals. Approximately 15% of the animals brought into the shelter are reportedly from the county. I can say with confidence this number is quite higher. County residents don't often tell the truth when bringing in an animal because they fear the animal will be immediately euthanized. This belief is not accurate. County animals are given the same adoption or rescue opportunity as any animal, whether stray or owner surrendered. It should be noted that 15% of the cost for the new shelter is $1.26 million. It is my understanding the consideration to be donated is $1 million. I truly appreciate this consideration as acknowledgement for all the city shelter does for the county animals and its residents.
Hi, this is Bailey reading the obituaries in the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Wednesday, January 15th. Joseph Anthony Tony Madrid, 69 of Midland, passed away peacefully Friday, January 10th. Tony was born in Isleta, El Paso County, Texas, on January 15th, 1950, to Ignacio and Rosa Beru Madrid. Tony is survived by his wife, B.J. Madrid, two children, son Cody Barrett Beru Madrid, fiancée Amanda of Sterling City, Texas, and son Corey Barrett Beru Madrid of Midland, Texas, and one awesome granddaughter, brother Ignacio Shorty Madrid, junior Sophia, sisters Amelia Anderson Martin, Anna Good, John Rebecca Madrid, Lourdes Pittinger George, Emma Joe Lackey Devon, Lisa Madrid, sister-in-law, Alicia Madrid, nieces, nephews, and many lifelong friends. Tony is preceded in death by his parents, Ignacio Sr. and Rosa Madrid, sister Maria Rellinger and brother Benjamin Madrid. Visitation will be Tuesday, January 14th, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home, Midland, Texas, with graveside services in Sterling City. Wednesday at 1 p.m., with Reverend Jim Noble of St. Luke's UMC of San Angelo officiating. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made to Sterling County VFW, P.O. Box 577, Sterling City, Texas 76951, or a charity of your choice. Juan Javier Espinoza Jr., 30, of Midland, Texas, passed away on January 11th. A visitation will be 12 p.m. to 9 p.m. on Wednesday, January 15th, with a prayer service at 7 p.m. at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. The funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. Thursday, January 16th at Greenwood Baptist Church in Midland. Interment will follow at Greenwood Baptist Church Cemetery. Juan Javier Espinoza Jr. was born on August 24th, 1989 in Dumas, Texas, to Gloria Casas Belmarez and Juan Javier Espinoza Sr. Juan is survived by wife Irasu Espinoza and his four daughters Jasmine, Alexandria, Alasia, and Adeline. His mother Gloria C. and Hector Belmarez, his father Juan Espinoza Sr., his sister Rebecca Espinoza and Richard Arios, brother Israel Espinoza, his maternal grandmother Katrina Casas, and many nieces, nephews, aunts, uncles, and cousins. Juan is preceded in death by his maternal grandfather, Joe R. Casas, and paternal grandparents, Manuel and Antonia Espinoza.
Girlfriend closely attached to son is distant to family. Dear Abby for Thursday. Dear Abby, one of my sons is dating a young woman who seems to care deeply for him, but is very cool and distant to our family. He goes to nearly all of her family's events, but she seldom comes to any of ours. She has been to one birthday get-together at a restaurant, a wedding, and a play where I bought the tickets for her, myself, and all my daughters-in-law. She has been invited to family dinners at one or another of our homes, Christmas celebrations, Thanksgivings, birthdays, you name it, but has not come to any of them. My husband and I hand make our gifts to her, which require a lot of time and effort. Last year, she sent us each a gift for Christmas. They have been dating for several years. When they are apart, she texts him constantly. I am confused and troubled by her indifference to us. We have been more than welcoming to her. Is there anything I or we could do to help her warm up to us? Flummoxed Mom in the South. Dear Flummoxed, have you talked with your son about this? If not, you should. You are already doing everything you can, so prepare to batten down the hatches. If your son eventually marries this insecure young woman, she will continue isolating him from his family and absorb him into her own. When the grandchildren come, they will spend the majority of the time with her family and not yours. It's harsh, but it's the truth. Unless your son is strong enough to put his foot down, it's exactly what will happen. You have my sympathy. Dear Abby, I am a naturally thin young woman. Oftentimes, especially when I'm working in offices with older women, my coworkers comment on their dissatisfaction with their weight and how they wish their body could be more like mine. To be honest, I don't equate thinness with beauty or fat with ugliness, but when I try to tell these women I think they are beautiful as they are, it's received with suspicion, as if they think I don't mean what I say. How can I respond to those who are unhappy with their weight without sounding insincere? I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. Thin in Florida. Dear Thin, when your coworkers compliment you about your figure, smile and say thank you, period. If they express dissatisfaction with their appearance, do not allow yourself to be drawn into the conversation. You can't alleviate their insecurities. They haven't believed you when you tried. Because the subject makes you uncomfortable, try changing the topic to another one. Dear Abby, is there a place where I can donate puzzles? I always make sure all the pieces are there. I put them in a zip bag inside a taped box, so anyone who gets them would be getting something that's as good as new. I have a whole closet full, and I need to find a place to donate them. They are too nice to throw away. Wanting to share in Washington. Dear Wanting, I am sure that if you call around, you will discover that senior centers, hospitals, nursing homes, libraries, churches, schools, and rehabilitation facilities could put those puzzles to good use. It's worth a try.
That's the end of the first hour of the Midland Reporter Telegram in Odessa American. We'll begin our second hour right after we take a look at weather.